You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Faye. It happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. When lightning strikes, where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hi, this is Gerald Brunner, and you're listening to When Lightning Strikes, when we talk about the tingly, heart-stopping, mic-drop moments that led you to becoming an artist. Dan O'Brien is a playwright and poet whose work has been produced off-Broadway at primary stages throughout the United States and in the United Kingdom. Some of his plays include The House in Scarsdale, a memoir for the stage, and The Body of an American. O'Brien has been awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship in Drama, the Horton Foote Prize, the Edward M. Kennedy Prize, and two Pen America Awards. Just this month, he published a collection of essays in his book, A Story That Happens, on playwriting, childhood, and other traumas. O'Brien reflects on theater, family, what it takes to be an artist in a fractured world, and keeping hope alive. Welcome. How are you, Dan?
Thank you. I'm good. Thank you for having me, Gerald. This is such a treat to be able to talk about the book. And I love the approach of this particular podcast to talk about those moments when things become clear.
Well, I love your approach to art and playwriting and your sense of hope in humanity. And we'll get to all that. But let's talk about your lightning strikes moments. What led you to becoming an artist?
Yeah, there's so, I mean, you know, I've been thinking for weeks now as I've been anticipating this conversation of different, you know, really many lightning strike moments and trying to think what was the biggest lightning strike. You know, I always knew, or I knew since I was a kid, I wanted to be a writer in some fashion. So it started pretty young. Of course, at that time, I also thought I would be a professional baseball player, perhaps the sixth or seventh member of the Beatles. So I had lots of dreams. But I always felt like I would be a writer of some kind. You know, theater specifically didn't really, I didn't really discover theater till I was older, probably when I was in college. Previous to that, though, I would say the biggest moment for me where I suddenly felt like there was something special about the theater for me in my life was reading Waiting for Godot. My older sister was going to college and she must have been taking a 20th century drama course, and she brought home a stack of books over Christmas break. And I remember I must have been about 11 or 12 and just being drawn to that. I don't know if you remember the old cover, maybe it's still the same cover illustration of Waiting for Godot, you know, the Grove Atlantic publication of the iconic tree with the two you know, characters, the two hobos, the vagrants, you know. And I just remember reading that play and being utterly bewildered by it, I guess, but also very moved by it, and in ways that I didn't really understand. You know, there was a kind of uncanniness or eeriness to how it affected me. And on one level, it just reminded me of the culture within the house I was growing up in. It felt very much like I recognized in some strange way, you know, what that play was about, and a childhood in a family that was full of secrets and denial and repression, and also an Irish American family. And this was an Irish writer. I connected to that as well. So that was the first play I read that really spoke to me and made me feel like, you know, maybe this is the type of writing I'm going to be most drawn to. And then it was actually coming to theater as a performer in college was the biggest development, was specifically comedy improv. I like to say that this was back when I was funny, is how I like to explain it. And it's actually how I met my wife. My wife and I were in the same comedy improv troupe at Middlebury College in Vermont. And that is such a direct experience of performing directly to an audience, you know, without a script, which is somewhat ironic because I'm a playwright. But in many ways, I think that means that improv is such a stripped down version of what theater is, of essentially what theater is, which is performer and audience, you know. And so that's really what awakened my interest in theater and probably writing specifically for the theater as opposed to novels or poetry.
Let's talk about how you went from reading Waiting for Godot when you were 12 to going to Middlebury College and studying theater. How did that happen?
The play obviously made a big impression as a reading experience, but I'd never seen it performed. So, you know, I still wasn't thinking aspirationally in terms of becoming a playwright. It that really came with performing. So again, it was doing comedy improv and becoming a theater major and performing in lots of plays at Middlebury College, which, you know, was a remarkable program, a small program, you know, only 3 full-time faculty members, 2 of whom were married to, or still are married to each other. But it was a remarkable program in that they did plays by living playwrights, often very political plays. The faculty had been very influenced by, you know, political British theater of the 70s and 80s. So I had in some ways a very atypical college theater experience. On the flip side, you know, I didn't do one musical or even any classical theater. It was all pretty much modern, sometimes fairly experimental political theater, which, you know, really excited me and kind of synced naturally with my interests and my talents. And it wasn't until I went to Ireland, I spent about a year in Ireland after college, and that's when I finally saw Waiting for Godot in person.
Oh,
and
okay.
That was an amazing experience too, because suddenly this play that had been on the page very haunting and evocative and poetic, really, for lack of a better word, suddenly I understood it as the comedy that it is, as it's such a human story, such a human experience. I even think there were certain Irish colloquialisms in the play when I read it that I thought were some kind of poetic stylized language. And when I was seeing it in Ireland with Irish actors and an Irish audience, suddenly the whole thing, the play felt a lot more human and accessible and funnier and sadder as a consequence. So that was a meaningful trajectory for me to go from being 12 and reading this play and feeling like it spoke to me deeply and I didn't know why, to seeing it in Ireland. And I went to Ireland in many ways because of that play and because of my interest in Irish theater and other Irish writers. So it was a real full circle lightning strike in many ways.
And what inspired you to pick up your pen and your proverbial pen and start writing yourself?
You know, I started so young. There's sort of 2 phases. One is I just started so young, probably because you know, I heard teachers and, you know, my mother saying things like, basically saying that I was talented at it. And I probably, like all children, like to hear that. I was in an experimental class for 2 years in elementary school, where every afternoon we just wrote stories. That's all we did. And we would bring our stories to a table in the corner of the room, and just like a graduate level workshop, we would critique each other's stories at the age of 10 or 11, you know. And yeah, as a consequence, I'm sure my geography or my math skills suffered. But, you know, this was an amazing gift for somebody who had a natural talent for writing and interest in writing. It wasn't until, you know, my family had a very, I think I've mentioned, significantly dysfunctional family. And when I was around 12, the family really kind of fell apart. And my older brother was suffering from untreated depression, and he had attempted suicide by jumping out the window of our attic, which was an event that I witnessed. And that's when I was 12. I don't know if this was before or after I read Waiting for Godot, interestingly. But it was around that age, very soon after, that I started to discover that writing about that experience, or writing about my emotions in general, was a way to feel better. You know, it was a way to feel better about life, was a way to feel like I was making something constructive or artful or beautiful or meaningful out of chaos or trauma or pain, you know. So it was really around that age, 12, 13, where something really fused for me, which is the idea of writing being the way that I could perhaps survive trauma.
Because your plays in particular are so deeply personal, right? I think about your play, The House in Scarsdale, the memoir for the stage. Is that basically about your family and the struggles you went through, you know, growing up in that household, right?
Right. Yeah. That's probably my most, as a memoir for the stage, as I call it, I'm sure it's my most personal naked offering, for lack of a better word. You know, the approach to that play was to, so to give a little background, about 15 years ago, I was suddenly disowned by my family without any, my birth family, my parents, without any explanation. And there were, of course, you know, it was a dysfunctional family. So in some ways, it wasn't surprising. In other ways, it was a shocking and traumatic experience. So I started researching that play a few years after that event, with the idea that I would approach it almost as a journalist would. I would approach my own disowning and my childhood as almost as an investigative reporter. And so what I did, my parents have a long list of relations that they've cut themselves off from. So I had cousins and aunts and uncles and a step-grandmother, you know, people that I knew a little bit in my childhood, but had been disappeared from my life. And so the play, you know, really was almost a docu-theater, creation, recreation of my investigation, you know, trying to figure out what happened, you know, why did this happen? Why was I disowned? Why was my family such an abject failure as a family? Searching, you know, in some ways searching for what psychologists call the happy answer, searching for like the one simple answer that could explain trauma or explain chaos. You know, of course, that's often not the case. Often the truth is complicated, and I think that's where the play ends. But the play's structure really follows a certain fantasy or delusion I had that perhaps my father's father could be my father, and I won't give away too much because that is the central question of the play. But it was about me trying to figure out, you know, is there an explanation for the dysfunction and the cruelty and the emotional and verbal abuse in my family. But it's been a while that I've been writing fairly autobiographically. The play before that, The Body of an American,
yes,
is much more about my friendship with Paul Watson, who's a war reporter.
Yes.
But I'm a character in that play as well. And
That to me is also, I mean, looking from outside The Body of an American and your connection with Paul, I mean, that to me feels like a, forgive me for saying, a lightning strikes moment where you are listening to NPR and you hear him. Do you want to tell that story? Because it's a fascinating story about listening to Fresh Air, right?
And
in 2007, I'll let you tell it.
Thank you. Yeah, it was. Yeah. It's the only time in my life, really, or in my career, where you know I heard somebody on the radio, or you know, and felt so moved by their story, but also kind of haunted by their story, and felt such a deep identification with that person. And it's the only time I've reached out to someone like that, just like I did to Paul. So I heard him on Fresh Air. He had just published a memoir about his 25 years in war zones. Specifically, the book, you know, his life is really focused around this one experience, taking a photograph of a fallen U.S. Army Ranger in the streets of Mogadishu in during the battle for Mogadishu, where the many people think of the Black Hawk Down film when they think of that period or that event. Paul was one of a handful of Western journalists who were remaining in Mogadishu because it was so dangerous. And he was there when a Black Hawk had been shot down. One of the soldiers had been dragged through the streets. Paul went out into the streets. He got to what turned out to be the corpse of a soldier. And he felt he should document it for various reasons. And right as he was about to take the photo, he heard a voice that he believes is the voice of that soldier. And he heard the voice say, "If you do this, I will own you forever." And he took the picture. And subsequently, he has felt that he's been literally haunted by the spirit of this individual. So that was at the core of his story and the core of that interview on Fresh Air, and probably what moved me and disconcerted me and fascinated me the most. So I reached out to him. He claims he never responds to strangers who write to him. And for some reason, he felt compelled to respond to me. And that started about 2 years of just kind of being pen pals, you know, just sort of... Because I didn't really know. I told him I wanted to write about him, but I didn't really know how to do it. I was overwhelmed in some ways by the material. You know, I'd never written about war. I was scared of it. So to some degree, I felt like I needed to acclimatize to his world. You know, and build up trust. Which luckily is what happened. And we eventually met up in person about 2 years later in the Canadian High Arctic, because he was trying to get out of war reporting and was writing stories about the Arctic for the Toronto Star. And so the second half of the play is ostensibly set in this little hostel where we stayed at the very northernmost coast of Canada. And, since then, that turned into, so that was a play that then turned in, I felt like I couldn't stop writing about him, and it became not one but two collections of poetry, and now a second play that's most recent and is still in development. As well as in there, there was actually an opera that I wrote the libretto for as well that was based on the play.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash. Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And you, in researching, I read Alexis Sulawski's New York Times review about Body of an American. And what she said was so poignant. She says, what Mr. O'Brien suggests powerfully is the need these haunted men feel for connection and their hope that by writing, by shooting, by Skyping, by drinking, by loving, they may start to make sense of their inexplicable lives. I thought that was so beautiful how the two of you connected on such a visceral level, you know, in a way that, in a sense, you're going through your own wars together. Do you want to talk about that? And also,
sure.
What's fascinating to me is that Paul Watson, tell me if this is still true, that he, because it was so traumatic, this experience, that he's never seen the play, or at that point, he hadn't seen it.
Yeah, he still hasn't. He still hasn't seen it. Yeah. For a while, he has a one of his siblings, his brother, was coming to many of the productions. But Paul himself, and Paul has come anytime he's been invited to be a part of, you know, audience talkbacks. He'll come and he'll do those. And, you know, sometimes that has been a humorous experience because in the talkback, he'll start telling stories that are in the play. And audiences will sometimes, especially in New York, you know, it's funny to see in New York, people are not, you know, shy to say, to call out from the audience, that's in the play. You don't need to tell us this again, you know? So that happened a fair amount, but it proved to me that he actually wasn't, he really was doing what he was saying, which was that he didn't, you know, he wanted to give to me as much material as I asked for. He allowed me to record all of our conversations and turn them into the dialogue of the play. And yet he didn't want to read it. So, it was an odd, I term it a peculiar collaboration in that sense that I really do feel like I wrote those plays and those two poetry collections with Paul. And then at the same time, he wasn't telling me what to write or how to write it or giving me notes, God forbid, you know, he was really trusting me. He said something interesting to me after many years, the one reason why he started working with me and why he continues to come give talkbacks and is that he feels almost like it's his penance in a way. He's not a religious person. I believe he would call himself an atheist, but I believe he's also used the word penance to talk about, you know, because this thing happened to him and many other traumatic experiences in war zones happened to him. He does feel like it's his responsibility to bear witness to what he's witnessed, to share that. He has significant PTSD. So these talkbacks and these talks come at, you know, quite a cost emotionally. But he's always been, you know, very quick to say, of course I'll be there. And, it's been from the beginning, I felt like it was perhaps once in a lifetime artistic experience to connect with somebody so deeply and to have it reciprocated, to feel like, you know, we were writing something together in its own strange way that was probably better than what we could write on our own. So if you take the big picture on that play, The Body of an American, it really is a story of friendship and bearing witness to each other's trauma and the healing power again of storytelling and theater because it specifically is a play. I feel very lucky. I think Paul felt too that it was almost kind of you know, eerie or uncanny. Yeah, exactly. Kismet is probably a better word, but there was some other, we just had a feeling like, oh, there's some reason why this is happening. It's kind of beyond our control, you know?
So great. And let's talk about a story that happens.
Sure.
Your new book of essays, and it's based on a series of lectures, right? That you get, well, I'll let you tell it.
Yeah. So let's see. In 2015, my wife was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer. And then about 6 months later, I was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. So we had about a year and a half of, you know, pretty traumatic times. Yes. I will say, you know, knock on wood, we're both, you know, four and a half years now, cancer free or in remission or no evidence of disease. But you know, that was a cataclysmic period of time for us that we're still working through. I'd been teaching at the Suwannee Writers Conference for many years, you know, almost every summer for about a decade. When this happened and I had to take that summer away from Suwannee, came back in 2017 and was invited to give a lecture, a craft lecture, they call them, to talk about anything really related to the craft of playwriting. So that summer and each summer since, I've been writing these essays, the lecture essays, that are about writing plays, but are very much informed by not just the experience of cancer, but what we've been talking about, my relationship with Paul Watson and war and trauma, as well as trauma and childhood. You know, trying to, I'm not interested in writing lectures telling people how to write anything, you know. That just seems like the height of hubris. And so on some level, I just wanted to write very personally about craft and about why I write plays the way I do, how that's changed over time, how it might change going forward, how it's been changed by the most recent challenge in my life. So, you know, that first, essay in 2017 is the first essay in the collection. And it's, you know, it's only four essays at this point. I like to think of it almost as a part one, I hope, you know, of a longer book, because it doesn't, I mean, I don't know if any book can cover every element of craft in playwriting, but I do feel like, of course, there's more to talk about. But this publisher in London and a US publisher upcoming, felt like the four essays together had a certain coherence and potentially a certain power. So they've published it this spring.
There's so much. I mean, it's just a feast in this book, the different essays. One sentence I love, you write, "Our wound was our gift, the mythical consolation. We were nobody, so that we could become everyone."
Mm-hmm.
You talk more about that. I just think that's so beautiful.
Mm.
Our wound was our gift.
Yeah, I mean, that's a sort of foundational or core belief for me.
Yeah.
You know, that artists are striving to heal themselves through art.
Yes.
And by extension, readers, audience members are going to, if they connect to the work, are going to experience some of that, some of that healing. So, you know, it goes back again to what I was saying about being 12 and experiencing that trauma in my family and realizing, you know, for some added context or, you know, around that time, right after my brother attempted suicide, I developed obsessive compulsive disorder. It may have been coincidence because, you know, often that's the age when that can develop. But I did find that writing helped a lot. You know, perhaps it used a lot of the same energies to control and to shape and to frame experience. But I think it was also just allowing me to give voice to my emotions. And I found that my obsessive compulsive symptoms were better, if not non-existent at times. So, you know, that's been with me since then, that idea that really I feel like I have no choice but to write about what I'm going through. It doesn't mean I can't fictionalize what I'm going through. And I've often done that. It's just that more recently I've been writing very non-fictionally about my experience.
You and your wife, Jessica St. Clair, wrote this deeply personal, very moving piece for the New York Times, right, about, as you mentioned, getting diagnosed with cancer within 6 months of each other, and also having a small child. And what really struck me, I mean, your honesty is so beautiful. You write, "I feel an obligation, even a privilege, to tell the truth of what we have been through. This is the same impulse that made me want to become a writer in the first place as a boy, discovering authors who seemed to reach out of their isolation into mine. What they wrote made me feel stronger and made me believe that it was and is possible to survive."
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really, really beautiful.
Thanks.
And so much learning there. Yeah. And you talk about how here you both survive these harrowing illnesses, and then now we're in the midst of a pandemic. Do you want to talk about how your illness and also and the last year, how have they both impacted you as an
artist? It's been a strange experience. I mean, it's been strange for everyone, as well as harrowing, and to be living through the pandemic. I think for people who have been, I mean, I had the feeling last spring, I wrote an essay for the Times Literary Supplement about just the eeriness of suddenly seeing everyone wearing masks the way cancer patients often wear masks to protect their immune system from, pathogens. And suddenly it seemed like the entire culture, the entire country, the world was in treatment for cancer, from my perspective. It suddenly appeared that way in a certain way, because we were all trying to protect immune systems that would have been, that are potentially really vulnerable to a lethal, pathogen. So it has been very interesting, fascinating, disturbing to see some of what Jessica and I experienced on a very personal, private level happening writ large on the culture, in terms of the trauma. And I feel like I'm still, trying to figure that out. I'm still observing, trying to figure out the similarities and differences between perhaps the private response to illness and the cultural response to illness. It's been really disturbing, fascinating, interesting to have the perspective of recent cancer treatment while living through a pandemic, It'll be interesting to see. I mean, what I'm thinking about for this summer at the Swanee Writers Conference is a lecture comparing, finishing cancer treatment to the culture now finishing lockdown. Yeah. So what I'm thinking about for a lecture, a craft lecture for this summer's Swanee Writers Conference is, comparing the experience of finishing cancer treatment to what we're all experiencing right now, the idea that lockdowns and quarantines are easing and perhaps ending at some point, that we'll be returning to, in some ways, a more normal life, which is how I felt 4.5 years ago finishing cancer treatment. Because, at that time, I had such an impulse to reinvent myself and to fix my life in any way possible, to change my life for irrational and rational reasons. At this summer's Writers' Conference, Swanee Writers' Conference, I'm hoping to write an essay lecture about comparing the experience of finishing cancer treatment and returning to normal life, or trying to return to normal life, to the experience we're all going through right now of trying to emerge from our quarantines or emerge from the pandemic to normal life.
Thank you so much, Dan, for being on. It's just been an honor having you. Thank you so much for sharing.
Great. Thank you, Gerald. It's been a real treat.
Still happens every day when lightning strikes. It's the moment you know.
The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore. And the talent was booked by Anna Stratt.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.